I understand, Cavendish says, but Thomas, he wails. You can't imagine what it's like here at Isha. What time is it, my Lord Cardinal says? What time will Cromwell be here? And in an hour, again, Cavendish, what time is it? He has us out with lights and reporting on the weather, as if you, Cromwell, were a person to be impeded by hailstorms or ice. Then next he will ask, what if he has met with some accident on the road? The road from London is full of robbers, wasteland and heathland, as the light fails, a-creeping with the agents of malefice. From that he will pass on to say, this world is full of snares and delusions, and into many of them I have fallen, miserable sinner that I am. When he, Cromwell, finally throws off his riding cloak and collapses into a chair by the fire, God's blood, that smoking chimney! The Cardinal is at him before he can draw breath. What said my Lord of Suffolk? How looked my Lord of Norfolk? The King, have you seen him? Did he speak to you? And Lady Anne, is she in health and good looks? Have you worked any device to please her? Because we must please her, you know. He says, there is one short way to please that lady, and that is to crown her queen. He closes his lips on the topic of Anne, and has no more to say. Mary Boleyn says she has noticed him, but till recently Anne gave no sign of it. Her eyes passed over him on their way to someone who interested her more. They are black eyes, slightly protuberant, shiny like the beads of an abacus. They are shiny and always in motion, as she makes calculations of her own advantage. But Uncle Norfolk must have said to her, there goes the man who knows the Cardinal's secrets. Because now, when he comes into her sight, her long neck darts, those shining black beads go click, click, as she looks him up and down, and decides what use can be got out of him. He supposes she is in health, as the year creeps towards its end, not coughing like a sick horse, for instance, nor gone lame. He supposes she is in good looks, if that's what you like. One night, just before Christmas, he arrives late at Isha, and the Cardinal is sitting alone, listening to a boy play the lute. He says, Mark, thank you, go now. The boy bows to the Cardinal. He favours him barely with the nod suitable for a burgess in the Parliament. As he withdraws from the room, the Cardinal says, Mark is very adept, and a pleasant boy. At York Place he was one of my choristers. I think I shouldn't keep him here, but send him to the King, or to Lady Anne, perhaps, as he is such a pretty young thing. Would she like him? The boy has lingered at the door to drink in his praises. A hard Cromwellian stare, the equivalent of a kick, sends him out. He wishes people would not ask him what the Lady Anne would and would not like. The Cardinal says, Does Lord Chancellor Moore send me any message? He drops a sheaf of papers on the table. You look ill, my lord. Yes, I am ill. Thomas, what shall we do? We shall bribe people, he says. We shall be liberal and open-handed with the assets your grace has left. For you still have benefices to dispose of. You still have land. Listen, my lord. Even if the king takes all you have, people will be asking, can the king truly bestow what belongs to the cardinal? No one to whom he makes a grant will be sure in their title unless you confirm it. So you still have, my lord, you still have cards in your hand.
And after all, if he meant to bring a treason...
His voice falters.
If
he meant to charge you with treason, you would be in the tower by now.
Indeed. And what use would I be to him? Head in one place, body in another? This is how it is. The king thinks, by degrading me, to give a sharp lesson to the Pope. He thinks to indicate I, as King of England, am master in my own house. Oh, but is he? Or is Lady Anne master, or Thomas Boleyn? A question not to be asked. Not outside this room.
The battle is, now, to get the king alone. To find out his intentions, if he knows them himself, and broker a deal. The Cardinal urgently needs ready cash. That's the first skirmish. Day after day he waits for an interview. The king extends a hand, takes from him what letters he proffers, glancing at the cardinal's seal. He does not look at him, saying merely in absent, "Thanks." One day he does look at him and says, "Master Cromwell, yes, I cannot talk about the cardinal." And as he opens his mouth to speak, the king says, "Don't you understand? I cannot talk about him." His tone is gentle, puzzled. "Another day," he says. "I will send for you, I promise." When the cardinal asks him, "How did the king look today?" he says, "He looks as if he does not sleep." The cardinal laughs.
"If he does not sleep, it is because he does not hunt. The icy ground is too hard for the hounds' pads. They cannot go out. It is lack of fresh air, Thomas. It is not his conscience."
Later, he will remember that night towards the end of December, when he found the cardinal listening to music. He will run it through his mind twice and over again. Because as he's leaving the cardinal, and contemplating again the road, the night, he hears a boy's voice speaking behind a half-open door. It is Mark, the lute player.
"So, for my skill, he says he will prefer me to Lady Anne, and I shall be glad, because what is the use of being here when any day the king may behead the old fellow? I think he ought, for the cardinal is so proud. Today is the first day he ever gave me a good word."
A pause. Someone speaks, muffled. He cannot tell who. Then the boy.
"Yes, for sure the lawyer will come down with him. I say lawyer, but who is he? Nobody knows. They say he has killed men with his own hands, and never told it in confession. But those hard kinds of men, they always weep when they see the hangman."
He is in no doubt that it is his own execution Mark looks forward to. Beyond the wall, the boy runs on.
"So when I am with Lady Anne, she is sure to notice me and give me presents."
A giggle.
"And look on me with favour, don't you think? Who knows where she may turn while she is still refusing the king?"
A pause. Then Mark.
"She is no maid, not she."
What an enchanting conversation, servants talk. Again comes a muffled answer, and then Mark.
"Could she be at the French court, do you think, and come home a maid? Any more than her sister could? And Mary was every man's hackney."
But this is nothing. He is disappointed. "I had hopes of particulars, and this is just the on dit." But still he hesitates and doesn't move away.
"Besides, Tom Wyatt has had her, and everybody knows it down in Kent. I have been down to Penshurst with the cardinal, and you know that palace is near to Hever, where the lady's family is, and the Wyatt's house an easy ride away."
Witnesses, dates. But then, from the unseen person, "Shh!" Again, a soft giggle. One can do nothing with this, except bear it in mind. The conversation is in Flemish, language of Mark's birthplace. Christmas comes, and the king, with Queen Catherine, keeps it at Greenwich. Anne is at York Place. The king can come upriver to see her. Her company, the women say, is exacting. The king's visits are short, few, and discreet. At Esher, the cardinal takes to his bed. Once he would never have done that, though he looks ill enough to justify it. He says,
"Nothing will happen while the king and Lady Anne are exchanging their New Year kisses. We are safe from incursions till Twelfth Night."
He turns his head against his pillows, says, vehement,
"Body of Christ, Cromwell, go home!"
The house at the Austin Friars is decorated with wreaths of holly and ivy, of laurel and ribboned yew. The kitchen is busy, feeding the living, but they omit this year their usual songs and Christmas plays. No year has brought such devastation. His sister, Cat, her husband, Morgan Williams, have been plucked from this life as fast as his daughters were taken. One day walking and talking, the next day cold as stones. tumbled into their Thameside graves, and dug in beyond reach of the tide, beyond sight and smell of the river. Deaf now to the sound of Putney's cracked church bell, to the smell of wet ink, of hops, of malted barley, and the scent, still animal, of woollen bales. Dead to the autumn aroma of pine resin and apple candles, of sole cakes baking. As the year ends, two orphans are added to this house, Richard and the child Walter. Morgan Williams, he was a big talker, but he was shrewd in his own way, and he worked hard for his family. And Cat, well, latterly she understood her brother about as well as she understood the motions of the stars. "I can never add you up, Thomas," she'd say, which was his failure entirely, because who had taught her, except him, to count on her fingers and puzzle out a tradesman's bill? If he were to give himself a piece of advice for Christmas, he'd say, "Leave the cardinal now, or you'll be out on the streets again with a three-card trick." But he only gives advice to those who are likely to take it. They have a big gilded star at the Austin Friars, which they hang in the great hall on New Year's Eve. For a week it shines out to welcome their guests to Epiphany. From summer onwards he and Liz will be thinking of costumes for the Three Kings, coveting and hoarding scraps of any strange cloth they saw, any new trimmings. Then, from October, Liz will be sewing in secrecy, improving on last year's robes by patching them over with new shining panels, quilting a shoulder and weighting a hem, and building each year some fantastical new crowns. His part was to think what the gifts would be that the kings had in their boxes. Once a king had dropped his casket in shock when the gift began to sing. This year, no one has the heart to hang up the star, but he visits it in its lightless storeroom. He slides off the canvas sleeves that protect its rays, and checks that they are unchipped and unfaded. There will be better years, when they will hang it up again, though he cannot imagine them. He eases back the sleeves, pleased at how ingeniously they've been made and how exactly they fit. The Three Kings' robes are packed into a chest, as also the sheepskins for the children who will be sheep. The shepherd's crooks lean in a corner. From a peg hang angels' wings. He touches them. His finger comes away dusty. He shifts his candle out of danger, then lifts them from the peg and gently shakes them. They make a soft sound of hissing, and a faint amber perfume washes into the air. He hangs them back on the peg, passes over them the palm of his hand, to soothe them, and still they shiver. He picks up his candle. He backs out and closes the door. He pinches out the light, turns the lock, and gives the key to Joanne. He says to her, "I wish we had a baby. Seems such a long time since there was a baby in the house." "Don't look at me," Joanne says. He does, of course. He says, "Does John Williamson not do his duty by you these days?" She says, "His duty is not my pleasure." As he walks away, he thinks, "That's a conversation I shouldn't have had." On New Year's Day, when night falls, he is sitting at his writing table. He is writing letters for the cardinal, and sometimes he crosses the room to his counting board and pushes the counters about. It seems that in return for a formal guilty plea to the praemunire charges, the king will allow the cardinal his life and a measure of liberty. But whatever money is left him to maintain his state will be a fraction of his former income. York Place has been taken already, Hampton Court is long gone, and the king is thinking of how to tax and rob the rich bishopric of Winchester. Gregory comes in. "I brought you lights. My Aunt Joanne said go into your father." Gregory sits. He waits. He fidgets. He sighs. He gets up. He crosses to his father's writing table and hovers in front of him. Then, as if someone had said, "Make yourself useful," he reaches out timidly and begins to tidy the papers. He glances up at his son, while keeping his head down over his task. For the first time, perhaps, since Gregory was a baby, he notices his hands, and he's struck by what they have become. Not childish paws, but the large, white, untroubled hands of a gentleman's son. What is Gregory doing? He's putting the documents into a stack. On what principle is he doing it? He can't read them. They're the wrong way up. He's not filing them by subject. Is he filing them by date? For God's sake, what is he doing? He needs to finish this sentence with its many vital subclauses. He glances up again and recognizes Gregory's design. It is a system of holy simplicity. Big papers on the bottom, small ones on top. Father, Gregory says. He sighs. He crosses to the counting board. With a forefinger, he inches the counters about. Then he scoops them together, picks them up, and clicks them into a tidy pile. He looks up at last. That was a calculation. It wasn't just where I dropped them. Oh, sorry, Gregory says politely. He sits down by the fire and tries not to disturb the air as he breathes. The mildest eyes can be commanding. Under his son's gaze, he asks, "What is it?"
"Do you think you can stop writing?"
"A minute," he says, holding up a delaying hand. He signs the letter, his usual form. "Your assured friend, Thomas Cromwell." If Gregory is going to tell him that someone else in the house is mortally ill, or that he, Gregory, has offered himself in marriage to the laundry girl, or that London Bridge has fallen down, he must be ready to take it like a man. But he must sand and seal this. He looks up.
Yes?
Gregory turns his face away. Is he crying? It would not be surprising, would it, as he has cried himself and in public? He crosses the room. He sits down opposite his son by the hearth. He takes off his cap of velvet and runs his hands back through his hair. For a long time, no one speaks. He looks down at his own thick-fingered hands, scars and burn marks hidden in the palms. He thinks, "Gentlemen, so you call yourself. But who do you hope to mislead? Only the people who have never seen you, or the people you keep distance with courtesy, legal clients and your fellows in the Commons, colleagues at Gray's Inn, the household servants of courtiers, the courtiers themselves." His mind strays to the next letter he must write. Then Gregory says, his voice small, as if he had receded into the past, "Do you remember that Christmas, when there was the giant in the pageant?"
"Here in the parish?"
"I remember."
He said, "I am a giant. My name is Marlin Spike."
"They said he was as tall as the Cornhill Maypole." "What's the Cornhill Maypole?"
"They took it down. The year of the riots. Evil May Day, they called it. You were only a baby then."
"Where's the Maypole now?"
"The city has it in store."
"Shall we have our star again next year?"
"If our fortunes look up."
"Shall we be poor now the Cardinal is down?"
"No."
The little flames leap and flare, and Gregory looks into them. "You remember the year I had my face dyed black, and I was wrapped in a black calfskin, when I was a devil in the Christmas play?"
"I do." His face softens. "I remember."
Anne had wanted to be dyed, but her mother had said it was not suitable for a little girl. He wishes he had said that Anne must have her turn as a parish angel, even if, being dark, she had to wear one of the parish's yellow knitted wigs, which slipped sideways or fell over the children's eyes. The year that Grace was an angel, she had wings made of peacock feathers. He himself had contrived it. The other little girls were dowdy goose creatures, and their wings fell off if they caught them on the corners of the stable. But Grace stood glittering, her hair entwined with silver threads. Her shoulders were trussed with a spreading, shivering glory, and the rustling air was perfumed as she breathed. Lizzie said, Thomas, there's no end to you, is there? She has the best wings the city has ever seen.
Gregory stands up.
He comes to kiss him good night.
For a moment his son leans against him, as if he were a child, or as if the past, the pictures in the fire, were an intoxication. Once the boy has gone to bed, he sweeps his papers out of the tidy stack he has made. He refolds them. He sorts them with the endorsement out, ready for filing. He thinks of evil Mayday.
Gregory did not ask, why were there riots?
The riots were against foreigners. He himself had not long been home. As 1530 begins, he does not hold an Epiphany feast, because so many people, sensible of the cardinal's disgrace, would be obliged to refuse his invitation. Instead, he takes the young men to Gray's Inn for the Twelfth Night revels. He regrets it almost at once. This year they are noisier and more bawdy than any he remembers. The law students make a play about the cardinal. They make him flee from his palace at York Place to his barge on the Thames. Some fellows flap dyed sheets to impersonate the river, and then others run up and throw water on them from leather buckets. As the cardinal scrambles into his barge, there are hunting cries, and one benighted fool runs into the hall with a brace of otter hounds on a leash. Others come with nets and fishing rods to haul the cardinal back to the bank. The next scene shows the cardinal floundering in the mud at Putney as he runs to his bolt hole at Esher. The students halloo and cry as the cardinal weeps and holds up his hands in prayer. Of all the people who witness this, who, he wonders, has offered it up as a comedy? If he knew, or if he guessed, the worse for them. The cardinal lies on his back, a crimson mountain. He flails his hands. He offers his bishopric of Winchester to anyone who can get him back on his mule. Some students, under a frame draped with donkey skins, enact the mule, which turns about and jokes in Latin and farts in the cardinal's face. There is much wordplay about bishoprics and bishop's pricks, which might pass as witty if they were street sweepers, but he thinks law students should do better. He rises from his place, displeased, and his household has no choice but to stand up with him and walk out. He stops to have a word with some of the benchers. How is this allowed to go forward? The Cardinal of York is a sick man. He may die. How would you and your students stand then before your God? What sort of young man are you breeding here, who is so brave as to assail a great man who has fallen on evil times, whose favour, a few short weeks ago, they would have begged for? The benchers follow him, apologising, but their voices are lost in the roars of laughter that billow out from the hall. His young household are lingering, casting glances back. The cardinal is offering his harem of 40 virgins to anyone who will help him mount. He sits on the ground and laments, while a flaccid and serpentine member, knitted of red wool, flops out from under his robes. Outside, lights burn thin in the icy air. "Home," he says. He hears Gregory whisper,
"We can only laugh if he permits us."
"Well, after all," he hears Ralph say, "he is the man in charge." He falls back a step to speak with them. "Anyway, it was the wicked Borgia Pope Alexander who kept 40 women, and none of them were virgins, I can tell you." Ralph touches his shoulder. Richard walks on his left, sticking close.
"You don't have to hold me up," he says mildly. "I'm not like the cardinal."
He stops. He laughs. He says,
"I suppose it was..."
"Yes, it was quite entertaining," Richard says.
"His grace must have been 5 feet around his waist."
The night is loud with the noise of bone rattles, and alive with the flames of torches. A troop of hobby horses clatters past them, singing, and a party of men wearing antlers with bells at their heels. As they near home, a boy dressed as an orange rolls past, with his friend, a lemon.
"Gregory Cromwell!" they call out.
And to him, as their senior, they courteously raise, in lieu of hats, an upper slice of rind.
God send you a good new year.
The same to you, he calls, and to the lemon. Tell your father to come and see me about the Cheapside lease.
They get home.
Go to bed, he says. It's late. He feels it best to add, God see you safe till morning.
They leave him. He sits at his work table. He remembers Grace at the end of her evening as an angel, standing in the firelight, her face white with fatigue, her eyes glittering, and the eyes of her peacock's wings shining in the firelight, each like a topaz, golden, smoky. Liz said, Stand away from the fire, sweetheart, or your wings will catch a light. His little girl backed off into shadow. The feathers were the colours of ash and cinders as she moved towards the stairs, and he said,
Grace, are you going to bed in your wings?
Till I say my prayers, she said,
darting a look over her shoulder. He followed her, afraid for her, afraid of fire and some other danger. But he did not know what. She walked up the staircase, her plumes rustling, her feathers fading to black. Ah, Christ, he thinks. At least I'll never have to give her to anyone else. She's dead, and I'll not have to sign her away to some purse-mouthed petty gent who wants a dowry. Grace would have wanted a title. She would have thought, because she was lovely, he should buy her one. Lady Grace. I wish my daughter Anne were here, he thinks. I wish Anne were here, and promised to Rafe Sadler. If Anne were older, if Rafe were younger, if Anne were still alive. Once more he bends his head over the Cardinal's letters. Wolsey is writing to the rulers of Europe to ask them to support him, vindicate him, fight his cause. He, Thomas Cromwell, wishes the Cardinal would not, or if he must, could the encryption be more tricky? Is it not treasonable for Wolsey to urge them to obstruct the king's purpose? Henry would deem it is. The cardinal is not asking them to make war on Henry on his behalf. He's merely asking them to withdraw their approval of a king who very much likes to be liked. He sits back in his chair, hands over his mouth, as if to disguise his opinion from himself. He thinks, I am glad I love my Lord Cardinal, because if I did not, and I were his enemy, let us say I am Suffolk, let us say I am Norfolk, let us say I am the king, I would be putting him on trial next week. The door opens. Richard, you can't sleep. Well, I knew it. The play was too exciting for you. It is easy to smile now, but Richard does not smile. His face is in shadow. He says,
Master, I have a question to put to you. Our father is dead, and you are our father now.
Richard Williams, and Walter named after Walter Williams, these are his sons. Sit down, he says.
So, shall we change our name to yours?
You surprise me.
The way things are with me, the people called Cromwell will be wanting to change their names to Williams.
If I had your name, I should never disown it.
Would your father like it?
You know, he believed he had his descent from Welsh princes.
Ah, he did. When he'd had a drink, he would say, Who will give me a shilling for my principality?
Even so, you have the Tudor name in your descent, by some accounts.
Don't, Richard pleads. It makes beads of blood stand out on my forehead.
It's not that hard, he laughs. Listen, the old king had an uncle, Jasper Tudor. Jasper had two bastard daughters, Joan and Helen. Helen was Gardiner's mother. Joan married William ap Evan. She was your grandmother.
Is that all? Why did my father make it sound so deep? But if I am the king's cousin, Richard pauses, and Stephen Gardiner's cousin, what good can it do me? We're not at court, and not likely to be, now the cardinal... Well, he looks away. Sir, when you were on your travels,
Did you ever think you would die?